Yes.
Okay, Camp Shoshana, we're ready for our walk through the book of Deuteronomy. We are continuing through this suzerain vassal treaty known as Deuteronomy, and we're in the specific stipulations of the covenant. So we're in chapter 14, verse 3. We'll pick it up at chapter 14, verse 3 with the specific comments and commands regarding the law of clean and unclean food. So let's take a look at verse 3. You shall not eat any abominable thing. That word abominable is the Hebrew word toivah. It means detestable. Something that is abhorred by God. Something that is abhorred by man. Then as we move into verse 4, the animal world comes into view. And we're told about the animals that is permissible to eat. Verse 4, these are the beasts that you may eat. And then the specific beasts are listed. The ox, the sheep, the goat, verse 5, the hart, the gazelle, the roebuck, the wild goat, the pygarg, that is probably an ibex or an addix. Nobody quite knows exactly what that animal is. The antelope, the chamu, which is a mountain sheep. And verse 6, the characteristics of these animals. Every beast that parts the hoof has the hoof cloven in two and chews the cud among the beasts that you may eat. So what's permitted is determined by these two characteristics, the cloven hoof and chewing the cud. But then the forbidden animals come into view, starting in verse 7. Nevertheless, these you shall not eat, of them that chew the cud, or of them that have the hoof cloven. Second part of verse 7. The camel, the hare, the coney, that's the rock badger. The reason, they chew the cud, but part not the hoof. They are unclean to you. Verse 8, the list continues. And the swine, that's the pig. The reason, because he parts the hoof, but chews not the cud, he is unclean to you. And then in verse 8, we have a summary. Of their flesh you shall not eat, their carcasses you shall not touch. So don't even touch the slaughtered bodies of unclean animals, of the forbidden animals. In verse 9, we come to the aquatic world, the water world, and the animals permitted in the water world by way of their characteristics. These you may eat of all the waters, of all that are in the waters. Whatsoever has fins and scales may ye eat. Verse 10, the forbidden. And whatsoever has not fins and scales, ye shall not eat. It is unclean to you. And now Moses moves into the avian world, the world of flight. Of all clean birds you may eat. Verse 11, verse 12. But these are they which you shall not eat. And the list begins. The eagle, the gyre eagle, that's the vulture. The osprey, verse 13. And the gledi, that's the buzzard, the falcon, the kite after every kind, verse 14. And every raven after its kind, verse 15. The ostrich, the nighthawk, the seamew, that's the seagull. The hawk after its kind, verse 16. The little owl, the great owl, the horned owl, verse 17. The pelican, and the vulture, and the cormorant, verse 18. The stork, the heron after its kind, the hoopoe, and the bat. And by the way, this is the hoopoe. It has recently been designated as the National Bird of Israel. So modern Israel, don't eat your national bird. It's a cute little thing, isn't it? Interesting bird there. All right, verse 19. All winged things. Well, the Hebrew literally means swarming things. These are creatures that swarm or crawl, insects, rodents, reptiles. All winged, creeping things are unclean unto you. They shall not be eaten. Verse 20. Of all clean birds you may eat. And again, literally, the word is more like flying creatures. And often this refers to insects. And in that case, what was permitted were those that had joined legs for hopping on the ground, a type of locust. Was allowed. Now in verse 21, we get some additional dietary rules. You shall not eat of anything that dies of itself, that dies a natural death, even if it's kosher. Well, because the blood has not been drained from it. What's permitted You may give it unto the sojourner that is within your gates, that you may eat it, or you may sell it to the foreigner. So the sojourner or foreigner are not required to observe the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law was given to Israel. Now verse 21. For you are a holy people unto the Lord your God. Now this phrase shows us that the meat itself was not bad. The issue here is not health. It was permitted for non-Jews. The issue here is that this is one way Israel would be a distinct people through our diet. A prohibition continues. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Now this was a pagan practice. It symbolized all that was evil in Canaanite culture. See, the milk was poured out as kind of a magic charm to guarantee fertility of the soil. In the Ugaritic tablets of the ancient Near East, they mention this practice. They say, cook a kid in milk and a lamb in cream. So this indicates that this is a Canaanite pagan practice, a superstitious rite to increase fertility and productivity. Now, in the Mishnah, Kulei 8:4, the rabbis make this verse the basis of the separation of milk and meat. And if you're familiar at all with that, a mountain of theology and practice is built on this pebble of truth. So the point of all this is, I want you to be a distinct people. Trust me with your food, with your diet, your sustenance. Now we come in verse 22 to the law of the tithe. And there were three tithes mentioned in the Bible. We have the Levitical tithe, the festival tithe, and the poor tithe. Here we're going to look at the second tithe. We'll go to verse 22. Thou shalt surely tithe of all the increase of your seed. Now the first tithe was that which was given to the priesthood. It was 10%. 10% of your income. So what we have in view here is our second tithe. This is the festival tithe. It was to be used by the family for worship at the three pilgrim festivals. It consisted of 10% of the remaining 90. It was, to be used by the family themselves, with a portion of it given to the priest. Now the frequency of this tithe, verse 22, that which comes forth from the field year by year. And verse 23, you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place which he shall choose, that's the location, to cause his name to dwell there. So ultimately, this will be eaten in Jerusalem. The tithe, your grain, your new wine, your oil, the firstlings of your herd and your flock. And the purpose of verse 23, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. Always. Now, what if you live up in the Galilee and you're a good distance away from Jerusalem? Verse 24 begins to answer that kind of question. If the way be too long for you, so that you're not able to carry it, because the place is too far from you, which the Lord your God shall choose to set his name there, when the Lord your God shall bless you with an abundance of crops, of course, the solution is an exchange in verse 25. Then you shall turn it into money, turn it into cash, and will bind up the money in your hand. So you keep the money in your money bag. Don't spend it along the way. And you shall go on to the place which the Lord your God shall choose. Make the trip to Jerusalem, verse 26, and spend it. You shall bestow the money, you shall spend the money for whatever your soul desires. For oxen, for sheep, for wine, for strong drink. And these two comments, these last two food items, shows that the law did not teach total abstention. Now, drunkenness for sure is forbidden, but responsible drinking of alcohol is not. The family is allowed to buy wine or strong drink for whatsoever your soul asks of you. In verse 26, the observance, you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice. Pay attention to that word. That's going to show up a lot. God wants us to have joy. You shall rejoice, you and your household. So the second tithe was to be a means of financing participation in the pilgrim festivals. Now, verse 27 turns our attention to the Levite. And the Levite that is within your gates, now this is the local fellow that lives in your city, you shall not forsake him, for he has no portion nor inheritance with you. He's got no tribal territory of his own. He's living in your city. So the Levite must receive a portion of the second tithe as well. All right, we've taken a quick look at the Levitical tithe, at the festival tithe, and now in verse 28 we're going to come to the core tithe, which if you put aside the money over 3 years, it would be 3.3% per year. So verse 28, at the end of every 3 years, so it's a triennial core tithe, again, if you saved up your money, it would be 3.3% per year. Now, it is not clear if this is an addition to the second tithe or in place of it every third and sixth year, but it seems best to consider it a third tithe. Verse 28. You shall bring forth all the tithe of your increase in the same year. That's the third year. And the place, you shall lay it up within your gates. That's your city. It's collected in the village. It doesn't go down to the central sanctuary. It doesn't go down to Jerusalem. This will be for local distribution for the poor. And so the recipients come out in verse 29. First of all, the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you. So the tithe provided for the Levite in their own village, and it was used by him then and there for his immediate needs. And the other category of people to receive this tithe are the dependent members of the community, the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow. And in verse 29, the purpose is brought out. The sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow that are within your gates, in your city, shall come and shall eat and shall be satisfied. The result, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. But trust God, he'll make up for any losses. So the third tithe basically financed God's social welfare program. Now this verse ends with the promise that God will bless unselfish generosity. And the point here, I want you to be a distinct people. Trust me with your money. Trust me with your diet. Trust me with your money. Now from the Bible Knowledge Commentary, I thought it was a worthwhile quote to share with you. The commentator writes, tithing is not commanded in the New Testament. Yet believers in the church age still indicate by their giving that God supports and cares for them. Christians are to give generously, knowing that they will also reap generously. So this is basically the same principle showing up in the brief of the show. Now we come to chapter 15 and verse 1 with the law of the sabbatical year. First of all, the law itself. At the end of every 7 years, you shall make a release. And there's three reasons for this release. One, for the sake of the poor, Exodus 23, 10, and 11. Number two, for the sake of the land, in Leviticus 25, verses 1 through 7. And now three, for the remission of debts. And that's what our focus is here, Deuteronomy 15, 1 through 11. This is our emphasis, the third reason for the tithe. Now, the best rendering of the verse is not after 7 years, but on the seventh year. It's a time for release of debts. The seventh year was the official year of release called by God. So the debts must be canceled in the seventh year. So now we get to verse 2 and an elaboration of this. And this is the manner of release. Every creditor shall release that which he has lent unto his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor. That's another Jewish person, of his brother, that's a family member, a kinsman. Why? Because the Lord's release has been proclaimed. Now there's an exception to this law in verse 3, and the exception is the Gentile. Of a foreigner you may exact it, you can call in the debt if you need to of a foreigner, but the Jew, but whatsoever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release. You'll forgive the debt for your fellow Jewish person. Now the ideal of this law is a lack of poverty. Verse 4. The goal is no needy or poor in the land. Howbeit, there shall be no poor with you. For the Lord will surely bless you in the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance to possess it. Now the basis is verse 5, obedience. If only you diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God, to observe to do all this commandment which I command you this day. Now obedience would mean that the circumstances of verses 1 through 3 would never arise. There would be no poverty if Israel was obedient. Verse 6 is the results of obedience. For the Lord your God will bless you, as he's promised you, and you shall lend unto many nations, but you shall not borrow. And you shall rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. So there's two results. Number one, the promise is immense prosperity for trust and obedience. But number two, worldwide influence, perhaps even worldwide financial dominance. And none of this would be due to Jewish technology, Jewish effort, Jewish wisdom, but due to God's blessings for obedience. Now in verse 7, we come to the poor. The poor come into view. If there be with you a poor man, one of your brethren, fellow Jewish person, within your gates in the land which the Lord your God gives you. So this is the response if verse 4 is not achieved, if poverty does show up in the land. You shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. Verse 8. But you shall surely open your hand unto him. You shall surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wants, that which he needs, that which he lacks. Verse 19 is a warning. Beware that there not be a base thought in your heart saying, the seventh year, the air releases at hand, and in your eye be evil, your eye be stingy, evil eye is a stingy eye, your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, give him naught. Why? Because you're afraid of losing because the sabbatical year is close. You're afraid of losing out on the loan. And the response, he cry unto the Lord against you, and it be sin to you. So this is a test of faith and generosity. Lending at a time just before the sabbatical year. In verse 10, we come to an admonition and a reward. You shall surely give him. And the word implies, give it as a gift. There's no time to pay back the loan. Your heart shall not be grieved when you give it unto him. And the reward for an obedient lender, an obedient giver. Because that, in this thing, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work, in all you put your hand onto. And the point, God is going to restore any losses. Trust him. Trust him. He'll make it good. He'll make it good. In 11, in verse 11, we come to the reality. God's very down to earth. For the poor will never cease out of the land. Now verses 4 through 6 was the ideal of perfect obedience, and obviously God did not anticipate perfect obedience. Jesus referred to this verse in Matthew 26:11. So the result, the poor will never cease out of the land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall surely open your hand unto your brother, to your needy, to your poor in your land. All right, our emphasis changes as we get to verse 12 and we come to the law of the bond slave. So the condition is in verse 12. If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, be sold unto you and serve you 6 years, then in the seventh year you shall then go free from you. And when you do, you'll provide for him. Verse 13. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty. What shall you provide? Verse 14. You shall furnish him liberally, generously, with livestock out of your flock, which provides milk and wool, out of your threshing floor and out of your winepress. So with livestock and with food and with drink, as the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give unto him. And the historical basis for this behavior is a memory. You shall remember that you were a bondsman in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. We left Egypt with much wealth. We didn't go out from Egypt empty. Therefore, I command you this thing today. Well, let's take a little bit of a rabbit trail onto the idea of biblical slavery. Biblical slavery is different from other forms of slavery because the person himself is not owned. You're not buying and selling a person. This was a contractual arrangement. It was a restoration to full freedom after 6 years. And the bond slave was given generous provisions at the time of freedom for a new start in life and being debt-free. So only the service of the bondsman was sold, only the service of the person was sold, not the person himself. He was a member of the Jewish community. And kidnapping or forced slavery was a crime punishable by death. We normally think of slavery as the buying and selling of the person. That is not the case in Israel. Buying and selling of the service. Now in verse 16, we come to the law of retention. What if this man or woman doesn't want to leave? And it shall be, if he say unto you, I will not go out from you, because he loves you and your house. This shows good treatment of the bond slave. Because he is well with you. He has financial security. He may not do as well on his own. And so the mark of the bond slave comes in verse 17. Then you shall take an awl. An awl is like an ice pick. And you'll pierce his or her ear. And thrust it through his ear to the door. Right? You know, take the lobe of the ear. Put it through the lobe of their ear. Just like that. Pierced ears that you ladies wear, or that I should say, a lot of people wear these days. Okay, you will pierce through his ear into the door, and the result, he shall be your servant forever. Now that particular translation is a little too strong a rendering of the word olam. The meaning of olam, of course, is determined by the context. Context is king. We're not talking about eternity here. The word can be used of eternity. But we're talking here of a long period of time. In context, it's going to be to the end of his life. He shall be your servant until the end of his life, is basically the idea. And also unto your maidservant shall you do likewise. And remember, this is a result of their personal choice. But what will be your attitude when you release a bond servant? It shall not seem hard unto you when you let him go free from you. For the double of the hire of the hireling has he served you 6 years. The point here is that the owner still comes out ahead, even when he gives the released slave generous provisions. Why? Because if he had hired somebody to do the same work for 6 years, it would have cost him twice as much. So he's still getting a good deal. And the promise of God, and the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. So here we go again. The idea, trust me. Don't be anxious. Don't be offended. Trust me with your business. Trust me with your business. In verse 19, we come to the law of the firstborn. The principle, all the firstling males that are born of your herd or your flock, you shall sanctify unto the Lord your God. Sanctify, set aside for special use. Set it aside for God. The prohibitions in verse 19, you shall not work with the firstling of your herd. So you don't benefit from its work. It belongs to God. Nor shear the firstling of your flock. Don't benefit from the wool. It belongs to God. Verse 20, you shall eat it before the Lord your God year by year. Now this will be applied once they settle in the land. In the place which the Lord shall choose, you and your household. But what if your firstborn animal is blemished? Verse 21. And if it have any blemish, this is the firstborn, if it's lame or it's blind or ill blemish whatsoever, verse 21, you shall not sacrifice it unto the Lord your God. See, offering a defective animal shows contempt. both to man and God. But what's permitted? You shall eat it within your gates, so it can be used for food. The unclean and the clean shall eat it alike, as the gazelle and as the hart. So the gazelle and the hart were non-sacrificial animals, so the blemished first fruits could be eaten by anyone without any ceremonial concerns. But there is a common law. You see this all the time, don't you? Only you shall not eat the blood thereof. You shall pour it out on the ground as water. So that's for sacrificial and non-sacrificial animals alike. Do not eat the blood. Now as we get to chapter 16, we come to the law of the pilgrimage feasts. And there are three pilgrim feasts. We start with the feast of Passover in chapter 16, verse 1. Observe the month of Aviv, later called Nisan, after the Babylonian captivity. Observe the month of Aviv. Keep the Passover unto the Lord your God. For in the month of Aviv, the Lord your God brought you forth from Egypt by night. And there's two requirements in verse 2. The first one, you shall sacrifice the Passover unto the Lord your God of the flock, that's the lamb or the goat, or of the herd, that's the cattle. Secondly, in the place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. And of course, eventually the permanent location would be Jerusalem. And the law of the leaven in verse 3. You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread thereof, even the bread of affliction. We know that's one of the names for the matzah. And so Passover is one day, but it's blended into the festival of unleavened bread, which is 7 days. And the reason for this is, again, based on your memory. For you came forth out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day when you came forth out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. Remember your history. Verse 4, there's two prohibitions. There shall be no leaven seen with you in all your borders 7 days. Neither shall any of the flesh which you sacrifice the first day at evening remain all night until the morning. So you're supposed to consume the entire Passover meal that night, no leftovers for lunch in the morning. And the place, verse 5, you may not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates, in your home or in your city, which the Lord your God gives you, verse 6, but at the place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell in, there you shall celebrate the Passover, you shall sacrifice the Passover at evening, at the going down of the sun, at the season you came forth out of Egypt. Now, some more, another Passover regulation, verse 7, you shall roast the Passover and eat it in the place which the Lord your God shall choose, and you shall turn in the morning and go unto your tents. So this terminology means to go back home. You know, they traveled to Jerusalem since this is a pilgrim festival, but they couldn't travel home until the second day of unleavened bread. Then they could head home. So this section looks forward to the time when additional revelation will come forth that Yeshua is proclaimed through the Passover. 1 Corinthians 5, 7 and 8. Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are, in fact, unleavened, for Messiah, our Passover, also has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice or wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So this truth will be brought out later in 1 Corinthians 5. Okay, returning to chapter 16, verse 8, we come to the feast of unleavened bread. 6 days shalt thou eat unleavened bread. On the seventh day shall be a solemn assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work therein. And after that short explanation, we come to the Feast of Weeks in chapter 16, verse 9. 7 weeks shall you number unto thee. From the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain shall you begin to number 7 weeks. Verse 10. You shall keep the feast of weeks unto the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering in your hand, which you shall give, according as the Lord your God blesses you. So this tribute is no set percentage, just as you're able. And verse 11, we come to the purpose. You shall rejoice. There's that word again, right? You shall rejoice before the Lord your God. You personally, your son, your daughter, that's your family, your manservant. Verse 11, your maidservant, that's your workers. The Levite within your gates, the sojourner, that's the Gentile, the temporary alien, the fatherless, that's the orphan without a family, the widow that is in the midst of you, that's the woman without a husband. In the place where the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. And of course, eventually, Jerusalem. And the basis, again, is our history. You shall remember that you were a bondman in Egypt. You shall observe and do these statutes. Then as we get to verse 13, we get a glance at the Feast of Tabernacles. You shall keep the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days. After you have gathered in from your threshing floor and from your winepress, so after the harvest, and in verse 14, the purpose, you shall, what's the word there? Rejoice. You shall rejoice in your feast. You personally, your son, your daughter, your family, your manservant, your maidservant, your workers, the Levites, the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow, that are within your gates. Okay, a few of the rules of the Feast of Tabernacles. 7 days you shall keep a feast unto the Lord your God in the place where the Lord shall choose, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your increase, in all the work of your hands. And again, the purpose, you shall be altogether joyful. Do we get the idea? God wants us to have fun, to enjoy life. So we have a summary of verse 16. Three times a year, all males appear before the Lord your God in the place that he shall choose. So only the adult men are obligated here, but the families were welcome. Households were encouraged. And the occasions are the three pilgrim feasts, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. They shall not appear before the Lord empty, that is, without an offering. Verse 17, every man shall give as he is able, so there's no set percentage, according to the blessing of the Lord your God which he has given you. So this is grace giving, just like we have in the Brit Hadashah, the New Testament. We live under grace giving today. The concept existed way back when. All right, now we're coming to verse 18 of chapter 16, and we come to some civil laws dealing with the judge and other officials. So we have the appointment of these officials. Judges and officers shalt thou make unto thee. Now the judges are the shoftim. They are the decision makers. They are the ones who apply the case law. The officers are the shotrim. They're responsible to keep the actual records and keep genealogical lists. They served as secretaries and advisors to the judges. And the places where they serve, city judges, in all your gates. And then the tribal judges, according to their tribes. In all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, according to your tribe. City and tribal judges. Now, how will they judge? What's the manner of their judgment? They shall judge the people with righteous judgment. Verse 19. A number of principles. You shall not rest. You shall not distort justice. Secondly, you shall not respect persons. So there's to be no partiality, no favoritism. Third, neither shall you take a bribe. You know, personal gain will not influence your decision, or should not influence your decision. For a bribe does blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. The bribe is very powerful. Verse 20. That which is altogether just you shall follow. And the Hebrew word for justice there is repeated for emphasis. And the reward, that you may live. This is the promise of a long physical life and inherit the land which the Lord your God gives you. Promise of security in the land. And now we come to that wonderful subject of idolatry. How are we going to deal with idolatry? In verse 21, we start with the Asherah. You shall not plant you an Asherah, any kind of tree, beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make. So these were poles made out of wood, a form of idol worship. Verse 22, neither shall you set up a pillar, which the Lord your God hates. These were made of stone, another form of idol worship. And then as we get into chapter 17, we have an application to blemish sacrifices. You shall not sacrifice unto the Lord your God wherein is a blemish, ox, sheep, or anything evil. Now, it's not a moral problem here. The idea here is the thing that's evil is damaged goods, crippled, blemished, injured. That's the idea here. Anything damaged. For that is an abomination unto the Lord your God. It's an insult to God and man to give them a damaged gift. Now, the application to apostates comes in verse 2. If there be found in the midst of you, within any of the gates which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman, so notice men and women are both legally responsible here, that does which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, in transgressing his covenant, verse 3, and has gone and served other gods, worship them, the sun, or the moon, or the host of heaven, which I have not commanded, what's your response? Verse 4 is an investigation. And it be told thee, and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire diligently. Now, these are the judges and the officers. They shall inquire diligently, thoroughly, responsibly. Behold, if it be true, and the thing certain, that such an abomination was wrought in Israel, verse 5 comes the punishment, then you shall bring forth that man or that woman who has done this evil thing unto your gates, that's the outside of your city, even the man or the woman, and you shall stone them to death with stones. Now the witnesses have a role in this execution. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses, he shall be put to death. So two are the minimum number. There's no maximum number. At the mouth of one witness, he shall not be put to death. So this sentence of death requires adequate attestation. This is not a lightweight decision. Now the order of stoning is in verse 7. The hand of the witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall put away the evil from the midst of you. So there's no appointed executioner. Everyone participated. Now when we get to verse 8 through 13, we're talking about the legal court of the priests and Levites. Verse 8. Now, if there arises a matter too hard for you in judgment between blood and blood, this is between homicide, which is premeditated killing, and manslaughter, which is accidental killing. You can't decide what's happened here. Between plea and plea, this is a civil case. You know, what's fair, what's just between these two? Between stroke and stroke. That's an assault with personal injury. You know, who started the fight? How did it begin? What's the problem here? Being matters of controversy within your gates. That's kind of generic matters of litigation. Generic lawsuits. So these verses cover the whole range of possible legal situations. So you can't figure it out. It's a tough situation. So what do you do? In the second part of verse 8, then you shall arise and get up unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose. Again, eventually that's going to be Jerusalem. And you're going to come in verse 9, unto the priests, the Levites, unto the judge that shall be there in those days. So this is the high priest, this is the judge. And you shall inquire, and they shall show you the sentence of judgment. So they're a court of appeal here. Verse 10, how do you respond? And you shall do according to the tenor of the sentence, according to the terms of the verdict, which they will show you from the place which the Lord shall choose, and you shall observe to do according to all that they teach you. Verse 11, it's repeated, according to the tenor of the law, which they shall teach you, according to the terms of the law, according to the judgment, which they shall tell you, you shall do. It's repeated over and over. You shall not turn aside from the sentence which they shall show you to the right hand or to the left hand. So there's no higher court of appeal. Follow through with this verdict. Well, what if a person is disobedient? Verse 12. And the man that does presumptuously means in pride and insolence, in not hearkening unto the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God, or unto the judge, even that man shall die. You shall put away the evil from Israel. So I think you've noticed that in Scripture, a major way of removing evil from society is the death penalty. And in verse 13, and all the people shall hear and fear and do no more presumptuously. Swift justice encourages a law-abiding society. And it must be swift and it must be just. Then the king comes into view in verse 14. Our focus is now on the king. When you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you, and shall possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set up a king over me, like all the nations that are round about me. Verse 15, the permission, you shall surely set him king over you. So it was God's will for Israel to have a king. But the king would come from Judah only, whom the Lord your God shall choose. Now God's choice for the first king was David from Judah, but the people's impatience led to the selection of Saul from Benjamin. Now the rules for kingship, verse 15, one from among your brethren shall you set over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. So a fellow Jewish man only. And here's some limitations on the king. He shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to the end that he may multiply horses. For as much as the Lord has said unto you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. Don't go back to Egypt for anything. Verse 17, dealing with the king's wives. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself. The reason that his heart turned not away. Now the rabbi said the maximum number of wives allowed for the king is 18. I don't know what I would do with 18 wives. Well, there's nothing in Scripture regarding that number. So, neither shall he multiply wives to himself, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. That's wealth. Now, the king is to be a constitutional monarch subject to the Mosaic law, verse 18. So he's to make a copy of the law. It shall be when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, this is the beginning of his reign, that he shall write a copy of this law in a book, out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. So he's going to go to the priests and Levites. They're the ones who preserve the text. He's going to get a copy from them. Verse 19. Then he reads the law. Now this deals with the education of the king. And it shall be with him that he shall read therein all the days of his life. This is a lifelong discipline. And the purpose is obedience, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and keep all the words of this law, all these statutes, to do them. Be obedient. Verse 20. That his heart not be lifted up above his brethren. See, the word of God would keep the king humble and stable. That he turned not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left. He was bound by the law, just as anyone else. He was not above the law. To the end, that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he personally and his children, his descendants, in the midst of Israel. So again, this passage anticipates that Israel will have a king. This is an anticipation already found in Genesis 49:10 with the Messianic king. So this king was to be God's choice. He had to be Jewish. He was to be God's servant and representative. He was not to increase beyond reason horses for military purposes, wives, either for pleasure or political alliances, or wealth for personal gain. He was to make a copy of the law and read it regularly all his life and obey it. And Solomon violated all of this in 1 Kings 10 and 11. Well, on that unhappy note, we move to chapter 18, verse 1, in the law of the priest. Verse 1. The priests, the Levites, even all the tribe of Levi, they shall have with Israel no portion or no inheritance. They'll have no land inheritance. They shall eat the offering for the Lord by fire and his inheritance. So the offerings are the inheritance of the priests. Verse 2. They shall have no inheritance among their brethren. The Lord is their inheritance. So the priestly ministry is their inheritance, as he had spoken unto them. Verse 3. And this shall be the priest's due from the people, from them that offer sacrifice. So they'll receive from the people meat. They'll receive an animal, ox or sheep. And the pieces of food they give to the priest, the shoulder, that's the right foreleg, the two cheeks, that apparently is the jaw bones, which would include the tongue, and the maw, the stomach. Apparently this is the fourth stomach. Apparently a favorite food, some kind of stuffed intestine or something. Don't ask me. And verse 4 is the non-meat offerings. The first fruits of your grain, of your new wine, of your oil, and then the wool, the first of the fleece of your sheep, you shall give him. And the reason in verse 5, excuse me, I missed verse 4 there, the first fruits of your grain and your new wine, and your oil, and the first of the fleece of thy sheep thou shalt give him. Now we're in verse 5. For the Lord your God has chosen him out of all the tribes to stand and to minister in the name of the Lord, him and his sons forever. Now we come to the case of voluntary service in Jerusalem, the circumstance, verse 6. If a Levite comes out from any of your gates, out of any of the cities or villages in Israel, out of all Israel where he sojourns, and come with all the desire of his soul, that means voluntarily, unto the place which the Lord shall choose, again, Jerusalem, eventually. Verse 7. Then he shall minister in the name of the Lord his God, as all his brethren the Levites do, who stand before the Lord. And his compensation, verse 8, they shall have like portions to eat, beside that which comes from the sale of his patrimony, from the sale of his property, his house and his personal goods. You see, he sold his ancestral home not out of poverty, but in order to serve at the central sanctuary full time. This is his motivation. So he's entitled to Levitical support. Now we come to the law against occultism in chapter 18, verse 9. The prohibition. When you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to do after the detestable things of these nations. Verse 10. There shall not be found in you, first, anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire. Now, there's three possible meanings of this phrase, pass through the fire, human sacrifice, trial by ordeal, or magical tests. It's connected with the worship of Moloch. Secondly, one that uses divination. This is a general term for the whole system of the occult. It means to give false prophecies or to determine the will of the pagan gods through omens. Third, one that practices augury. This refers to apparitions of some sort, determining the will of the gods by reading the formations of clouds or some other media like that. Fourth, the enchanter. This is divination through object actions or words, using omens to determine the will of gods and the way that light is reflected from a liquid on a cup or something like that. Fifthly, the sorcerer. This means witchcraft, practicing magic by incantations. It includes gaining information through the use of herbs for magical purposes. In other words, drugs, getting high. Verse 11, a charmer. This is somebody who casts spells to control people. 7, a consulter of a familiar spirit. These are spiritistic mediums. A witch who inquires of a spiritual demon or a spiritual being. A fortune-telling spirit, this kind of thing. 8, a wizard. This is of gaining supernatural knowledge through communication with the evil world of supernaturalism. 9, the necromancer. This is a medium who claims to communicate with the dead, calling up the spirit of the dead. Now, the Rosh Shamra text of the ancient Near East, of Ugarit, shows that these were common practices among the Canaanites, affirming the biblical observation. And the results of these practices are demonism, sexual perversion, and violence. I read that. I couldn't help think of the culture of America surrounding us these days. We're going down the exact same road that Israel is warned about. All right, enough preaching here. Verse 12. For whoever does these things is an abomination unto the Lord. Because of these abominations, the Lord your God does drive them out from before you. So God is offended by all these practices and will drive out the Canaanites. But what about Israel? Verse 13. But thou shalt be perfect with the Lord your God. Perfect. Ethically sound and with undivided loyalty. That's what God wants. Verse 14. For these nations that you shall dispossess, hearken unto them that practice augury, unto diviners. But as for you, the Lord your God has not suffered you to do so. So a couple of reasons to avoid occultism. They're an abomination before God. He's revulsed by these. And Israel is God's people. They don't need other supernatural connections. They have one with the Lord. You know, as I read this, unfortunately, I think of modern Israel today, and superstition is alive and well in the Jewish world today, both here and in Israel. For example, this was a little article from the AtlantaJewishTimes.com that I happened to read in 1999, The World of Jewish Superstition. Maria D. from Morningside contributes to the article. You should wear a red ribbon or something red, not to give you a kenahora, an evil eye, and you should not brag. Okay, what's she talking about here? She's talking about a red string, a Kabbalistic red string, or something red. You buy these red strings, you get them on the internet. That's where I got that picture. And you put that red string around your wrist. Why? Why would you do that? Here's the reason. The red string bracelet instills faith and protection. And empowers the bearer. And you see this, the last time I was in Israel, I saw this all over the place. The ultra-Orthodox going around with their red strings. I remember with a tour with my brother. He comes walking up to me and he's got this red string around his wrist. Ken, what do you got on your wrist? Oh, I don't know, something just came up and stuck it on me. Well, here, the idea here is you're placing your faith in a piece of string. A piece of string is going to instill faith in you. A piece of string is going to protect you. A piece of string is going to empower you. Superstition to the max. Okay? But let's not look at Israel and point at Israel and say, let's take a look at the Christian community. Here's a little article I picked up recently. Christian witches to host a magical convention in Salem, Massachusetts. Isn't that wonderful? So in the Christian world, Christendom is getting into occultism today as well. So, all right, I'm exactly on time, both tonight and in my notes. So we'll pick this up next session with the Law of the Prophet in chapter 18. Any announcements there, Hruti, anything at all? Nope. All right, have a good night's sleep. Oh, what?
Question.